Greetings, and thank you for joining Disability in Progress, where we bring you insights into ideas about and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Thanks so much for tuning in. Charlene Dahl is my research PR person. Hello, Charlene.
Hello, everybody, on this grand summer day.
At least in Minnesota. Aaron is my podcaster. Thank you, as always, Aaron. And I want to remind those listeners, I appreciate you. And if you want to be on the email list, you can email me at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. Let me know what you'd like to hear and different topics you'd like me to cover. Tonight, we are covering primary care. We have Dr. John Hallberg. Hello, Dr. Hallberg.
Hi, Sam. Thank you so much for having me here.
Dr. Hallberg is joining us to talk about primary care. Do you really need a doctor? A primary doctor, anyway? Yes. So can you start out by giving me, I know you've done a lot of things, but a little bit of your history and how you got to the path you're on today.
Sure. So I'm a Minnesota kid. I was born in New Ulm. I had a chance to live overseas at one point in my life when I was a young person. But I've spent the rest of my life in Minnesota. I went to college here. I went to med school here. I did my residency just up the street at what was called Smiley's. The original location was right on Riverside Avenue. And then we moved over to Franklin Avenue for the duration of my training. And now it's over on Hiawatha. When I finished my family medicine residency, I practiced in downtown for 5 years at a Fairview clinic. And then in 2000, that closed. And then I found myself over at the university. So I have kind of risen the ranks over the years. I'm now a professor of family medicine and community health. But my main identity is that I'm a family physician. I'm a primary care physician. And I have about 1,000 people in my practice panel.
Wow.
My youngest patient is 3 years old, and my oldest is 102.
So I love the fact that
I have almost 100 years of the human condition that I get the privilege of seeing and taking care of and being part of.
I love
really
that. That's such a vast amount of knowledge you have to carry for each person. I'm wondering if you could talk about what does exactly a primary care doctor do and how they are different from specialists.
Yeah, let's start there. So I think that when you think about primary care, I mean, it's not exactly the same as being a generalist, but if you're a family physician, that is really true. You know, we often say that we're a jack of all trades, a master of none. But I think we're really, really good at taking care of the human condition, reading a room, reading people, understanding, you know, what makes them tick, their context, their community in which they live, their wants and desires. And so, you know, a primary care, we are the opposite then of a specialist, you know. And I think of specialists, a nephrologist, for example, they take
kidneys.
Care of the kidneys. Exactly. Yep. Neurologists, the brain and nerves, cardiologists, the heart. You can even be more, you know, not just a GI specialist, but you could be a hepatologist. You could study just the liver. So, you know, and I kind of think like they're not PhDs necessarily, but it's kind of a way of thinking about that. Like they've really gone deep. They really understand everything about the heart. Or even within cardiology, there's like electrophysiology cardiologists. They just really focus on the electrical activity of the heart. So it gets really, really specialized. I'm the opposite. My colleagues in primary care, I often say it's kind of the liberal arts approach to medicine. Like we just sort of, life is an open book and we're looking at things very largely and holistically. But at the same time, I need to know about the heart and I need to know about the kidneys and everything. So it's a tough job. I mean, there's a lot to know and I know what my limits are. But I think, you know, generalist versus specialist, big, big picture, very small picture. And then primary care is also like it should be where people start, you know, almost regardless of what your condition is. You should start with a primary care physician, a clinician. And I'm very careful about saying that, by the way. We'll talk, I think we'll talk
yes.
about the difference between a physician
yeah.
and a PA or
and,
an MP.
Yep, and, yep. And so your idea is that somebody should have a consistent primary care provider. Why do you feel that is so important for long-term health?
Yeah, I mean, I think if anyone who's listening can probably say to themselves, like, well, you know, I've gone in to see somebody. I always feel like I have to start over. I have to tell my whole story every time. They don't know who I am.
Right.
And it's not going to be cold, but I think it's not going to be like, I mean, honestly, I've been doing this for 30, this is my 30th year of doing this, and some people I've known literally 30 years, and some since literally they were born, so now I have like 30-year-olds who I've known since they were 2 weeks old.
Right.
And we just pick up where we left off. It's like, how are you doing? Oh my gosh, I just saw a young man yesterday, he's 15, he's a high school freshman, and I haven't known him since he was 2 weeks old, and he talked about his soccer playing, and is he on, what's he doing this summer? What's the class that he likes the most? And it's just so fun because it's just like I know his family. I know what makes him tick. I've watched him grow up, and just multiply that 1,000 times in my case. It's just a great privilege. On my side, on the patient side, I think it's just, that whole piece, like someone knows me. And I always think of this too. Let's say that we're sick, or let's say we go to the emergency room, and anyone who's been in the ER, they always say, well, I want you to follow up in 1 week with your primary care physician. And if you don't have somebody, how do you get your medication refilled, or how do you have somebody help you interpret what that x-ray showed? Or, because let's face it, being hospitalized, having surgery, being in the ER, those can be really scary situations. And I think that we in primary care, in a way, are like a guide. Not a guide through life, but kind of a guide to be at your side through life and help put things in context, help explain things. I can't tell you how many times people will say, like, oh, I'm so glad that I saw you. You put my mind at ease. I'm glad that, we've got a plan. That's a big part of it, too, like just being rudderless, not having a plan, not having a direction.
Right.
We can help with that.
So let's talk about that. I wonder, there's physician assistants and or PAs, and I think that there's other generalists too. So what is the difference between them and you? And should we expect them to be as knowledgeable all across the board?
So let's start with PAs. First of all, we talk about this term APPs a lot, and that's Advanced Practice Providers.
Okay.
So that can include PAs, physician assistants, but also NPs, nurse practitioners. And that's kind of evolving quite literally as we speak into DNP programs, which is a doctor of nursing practice. And the University of Minnesota has one of the largest programs of its kind in the country. Mm. So historically, we've said, well, these are physician extenders, and that's not really the way to think about it. I think that many, and I've worked with, in fact, the clinic I'm working in now, we opened with a PA and an NP and me. And so it was like we were the three clinicians that opened that, a very holistic kind of way of doing it. So I look at it as not competition. It's complementariness. And I think the reality is that in primary care, there have been fewer people going into family medicine, general internal medicine, general pediatrics. So we need others to help fill the gap.
And why do you think that is?
Well, okay. I mean, this is always embarrassing to say this, but medical school in the United States, you have to pay for it. So you pay up front.
Yeah.
People are hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt just for the privileges that were to go to medical school.
Right.
You have to pay that debt back. Mm-hmm. And the reality is, in medicine, there's a hierarchy. If you want to become an orthopedic surgeon, an ophthalmologist, dermatologist, some of these, you do stuff, you do procedures, you're paid much, much more than a primary care physician. So even though we do the most in a way, like we do everything to some extent, we're at the bottom along with the psychiatrists. And so there's just that fact, and I hate to even bring that up, but it's true that there's that element of it. I also think that, for example, people are probably watching Pitt on TV or, watching these shows in ER. It's exciting. It's dramatic. Mm-hmm. When you're done with your shift, you're done with your shift. You can go home. You can go to your family. You can kind of turn off that part of your brain. You're done. In primary care, it never stops. You're never done. And I think about that as I'm approaching my 60th birthday. I've been doing this for 30 years. It's heavy. I mean, it's a I don't want to say it's a burden, but it's a lot, because every time I see a patient, it generates follow-up with lab results or x-ray results. And then typically patients have questions about those, and we're going back and forth. And so when we're feeling a little overwhelmed, we kind of say, like, oh, it feels kind of like whack-a-mole. Like every time we hit one, nothing pops up. Or, Greek mythology, it's Sisyphean, right? We're rolling that thing up, and the end of the day, it comes back down. We have to roll it up the next day and start all over again. So that's the negative approach to it. Again, the positives for me, in a best of my days, it's like, wow, I get paid to listen to stories all day long. You know, if I think of it that way, that's what a privilege that is. So, you know, we have good days, we have bad days. But back to the difference. So PAs historically would be a college graduate. They go to school for 2 years. And by the way, the origin of the PA program is fascinating. It started because of medics in Vietnam being really, really good at what they were doing. They really were good, you know, in the field, saving people's lives. They had all this medical training. Mm. But what do you do with it?
Right.
So they actually created the physician assistant program. And I believe it was either Yale or Duke that started. I think those are the first two programs in the country that started it as a pathway then to becoming like sort of an actual licensed healer, you know, a caregiver.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Nurse practitioners evolved out of being an RN, you know, more advanced training. Nurse midwives are, you know, one path you can go. You can become a certified nurse anesthetist, another pathway. Others will be like family nurse practitioners. And so it's a different kind of training. Medical school historically was 4 years of college, 4 years of medical school. Historically, the first 2 years of medical school are like basic sciences. I always joke that the first full year is, it's like learning a foreign language. You're doing anatomy, you're doing histology, biochemistry. I think of like Legos, like you're learning all the pieces, all the parts, how it all fits together and how it all functions essentially normally, how drugs work. Mm-hmm. And then the second year of med school, which is kind of overwhelming, and it was overwhelming for me as a young, 23, 24 years old at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You start to learn every single thing that can go wrong with every single part of the body.
Oh.
And so it's like a lot. And
yeah.
Many of us, you know, get anxiety, get some depression, get overwhelmed.
Right.
So that's a lot. And then you spend the next 2 years becoming like, you're kind of getting more comfortable with, okay, this is my OB rotation. I'm going to learn how to deliver babies. This is my surgery rotation. I'm going to learn how to scrub in and assist in surgery. This is my pediatric rotation. I'm taking care of sick kids. And so we rotate through different specialties, psychiatry, neurology, family medicine. And then your fourth year of med school is like, now you're kind of honing in a little bit more on what you think you want to become. Then you've got 3 years at least of a residency,
mm-hmm.
3 years
mm-hmm.
to 5 years to 7 years. So it's a totality and depth of training. PAs, it's 2 years and now it's really turning into 3 years. DMP programs vary. Some of that work is done online. So it depends on what you're doing, how you're going about it. But I think that in my own experience, when I've worked with PAs and MPs, I mean, we're colleagues. I mean, we're there together doing very similar things. I think a lot of times, like, if you're in a clinic and you've got a physician and MPs and PAs, a lot of times a physician will be the medical director of the clinic. They'll be doing some, you know, leadership kind of stuff, helping to kind of guide the ship, as it were. But knowing that we just have, you know, other people that are kind of ultimately providing the same sort of care, we just have different titles.
You know, since we're on this, I'm going to ask you this now, because I feel like I've observed different doctors and some just a few PAs, and I never feel like people are necessarily created equally. And when I say that, I feel like there are some that I feel put so much more time into knowing the vast, because I realize you guys have to know a little
mm-hmm.
about a lot. It's like, but you have to know enough that you know, not, I think, where your limits are and
mm-hmm.
and when you need to tell the person to go for something else, right?
That's right. So,
but I feel like there are some that just aren't as top rated. I'm wondering, like, do you have expectations, like CEUs you are required to do? Are they required? Do you just choose to do them? Are there levels that you are required to keep up with?
Absolutely. So in fact, I just got an email before I came over here today saying that I'm on this 5-year cycle with my accreditation. And honestly, I have to be not just board eligible, but board certified in order for insurance plans to cover me. So I have high incentive. I can't practice without that certification. So I sit for a big exam every 10 years. We have to do at least 50 CEUs, or we call them CME credits, continuing medical education credits every year. But I think what you're getting at is maybe less about, I mean, because honestly, I think that almost every physician or NP or PA that you'll encounter, they're like technically competent, right? That we've all passed our exams.
Right.
Like we all have certain level of smarts.
Right.
And I think that that's taken for granted. What I think it's really, where it really comes down to where the changes are, it's personality. And it's how do I say this? I mean, I think it's like love of what you do. I was drawn to family medicine, primary care, because I'm really interested in people. I'm interested in their stories. I'm interested in what makes them tick. And I hope that that comes through when I'm in a patient visit, even if it's for a sore throat or a urinary tract infection. I just have to take a couple minutes just to kind of get to know somebody a little bit. But not everybody has that degree of curiosity. Not everyone really, frankly, cares. You know, they just want to kind of get through the day. It's a little bit more of a job than a calling. I mean, it's always a calling, but I just think that, and then we're people too. And so I think that sometimes, you know, let's face it, we have bad days. We have good days. People are going through stuff. It's the classic story of, like, you never want to assume anything because you don't know what's happening in that person's life, you know, behind the scenes.
Right.
But that does get at professionalism, though. And I do instill this when I have medical students with me. It's like, look, if I don't, you know, not that I don't care that you're having a crappy day, but you've got a job to do. You've got to take care of these people who are scared and they're sick and they want reassurance. And when we knock on that door, it's like curtain up. I mean, it's not that we have to act.
Right.
But you just have to be professional about it. And if whatever's going on in your life is so affecting you that you cannot do that, then you need to take a leave. You need to back out and you know, get some help yourself. Because it's just so critically important that we have an on day. We have to be there, present, listening, fully there.
You know, you talk about patients, you know, having needs and being scared, or maybe they're coming in for something that's difficult. And sometimes you have to coordinate with other specialists. How do you do that and to make sure that that goes well across the board?
Yeah. So I kind of look at my life and career almost in two parts. So when I was in training residency for 3 years, and then when I was in my first 5 years of practice, that was all in the 90s, you know, up till about 2000. We would kind of do it all. I would round at the hospital in the morning, rub shoulders with my specialty colleagues, go through the quote-unquote doctor's lounge, say hi to a few people, then head to clinic, see patients, and then I might come back to the hospital and see somebody that got admitted and write some orders. There was a very hands-on kind of approach at that point. Like, you had your friends. I mean, my friend, the infectious disease specialist, my friend, the cardiologist, my friend, the surgeon. And so it was very collegial, very, not chummy, but very small town in a way. And I think that my colleagues who practice in the, you know, greater Minnesota, rural America, a lot of the smaller hospitals are probably still like that. The bigger hospitals, well, what's happened is that we've shifted now so that we have hospitalists. So we have, like, you know, like, I don't go to the hospital to see my patients anymore. Like, I turn them over. They go through the emergency room. They're admitted to the hospital. There's a team, a wonderful team, really skilled team, but they don't know who this person is generally unless they are there all the time. In a more commonplace way, like in the outpatient setting, so that's where I live, you know, if I've got somebody in the clinic who has high blood pressure, they're on four medications, I can't seem to get their blood pressure down, I know when it's time to call on the specialists. And so I will place a referral. I mean, it seems a little anonymous sometimes, but I just write it in the electronic medical record. I will give the patient the number to call if they haven't heard from the people. But as a primary care physician who's been doing this for a long time, who's grown up in this area, I have all my favorites. I have all my favorite specialists. And I do like to think that there's sort of an art to a good referral. And if I have the opportunity, I'll say, okay, you have a hernia. I want you to see Dr. Granja, for example, because he's my favorite general surgeon. I know he's going to take good care of you. Or if you need a knee done or a hip done, I've got my specialist there, my favorite electrophysiology cardiologist. So I would bet that all of my primary care colleagues have that sort of bench, that lineup, to use the sports term. You know, they kind of know who they like to refer to.
Yeah.
And then part of our job as a generalist too is to, I always think part of the art of a good referral is to have, like, look, I know they're going to want to have that test done. Why don't I go ahead and order that? So when you go to that visit, it's all there. They have all the information. They've got the lab results, they've got the imaging studies, they can see everything, they can weigh in, they can make a really good informed decision, rather than I'm just going to send you this person, and then they have to order a bunch of stuff. Then you have to go back. It just drags it out.
Right.
So I think that it's incumbent upon us as primary care physicians to be, I don't like, you know, people often refer to us as the quarterback or the captain of the ship. It sounds like that's too big. I don't think the metaphor quite works. But there is something about that. Like, I am there to be the patient advocate.
Right.
To kind of like help guide them through. And often this is scary, right? We saw something on your mammogram. We saw something on your CT scan. I need you to see this person or see this oncologist. But we are the home or the safe harbor for people to come back to.
And I do feel like I know it's really hard. I mean, I've been in a position where I've had to do this, where I got referred to somebody and they rubbed me the wrong way, so to speak. It's just, it was either bad bedside manner or bad communication with me as a person with a disability. And I was like, whoa, I don't ever want to. So if you have it in you, I just want to say, because I think sometimes it can be so exhausting, it's difficult to reach outside and do this. But if you have it in you mentally, seek a second opinion. Like, I don't ever try. I feel like I don't ever trust the first. I nod my head at the first referral that, you know, a doctor might give me. But then I say, okay, I want some other ones because I'd like to do, you know, research them if you can.
Yeah.
And see who's out there, because sometimes somebody might do procedure X and the other one won't. There is a difference, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I'll go back to primary care too. I mean, if someone's establishing with a clinic and it's like, oh my gosh, I did not hit it off with that person.
Mm.
Well, you don't have to stick with that person. I mean, there's other options within the clinic, or of course there's other clinics to go to, because I think I think that's even more important, is to have a really good relationship with a primary care provider, because that's long lasting. That's like, you know, potentially years in the making. But I agree with you. If you feel like you've seen a specialist and you do not click, that you need a second opinion. Absolutely.
You know, we're going to come back to what you just said, but we need to take a short station break. We'll be right back.
Interested in starting a business or exploring entrepreneurship?
Neighborhood Development Center is offering the Planet Fall Cohort, a multi-week training program designed to support individuals in developing a business plan.
The program covers key topics such as budgeting, marketing, and business operations with guidance from experienced instructors.
Participants will also have the chance to engage with peers, exchange ideas, and learn from guest speakers with experience in various industries.
Applications are now open. The deadline is June 27th. Find more information at ndc-mn.org.
And this is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. My name is Sam. I'm the host of the show. This is Disability and Progress. We're speaking with Dr. John Halberg, who is a primary care physician. And Dr. Halberg, I want to touch on something you said, because, I mean, I actually am sort of at that crossroads personally. I will say I had a doctor, and it was a PA, and I just felt like they either they weren't keeping up, or they were always kind of bored of me or whatever. You know what I mean? There's just this feeling of, oh, they didn't take me serious when I was telling them something. I didn't feel heard. The list goes on. And I felt like I need somebody different. It just wasn't gelling anymore. And I'm sure things changed in their lives too. But so I go back to, how do you find what's going to match you? Sometimes I've gone into a doctor and feel like where they will totally miss the whole how to deal with somebody with a disability, depending on the disability you have.
Mm-hmm.
It really is, I think, a dance that you have to do between doctor and patient. So what would your thoughts be on the best way for somebody with or without a disability? Because just because you don't have a disability doesn't mean that you don't have special emotional needs, that if something you want to have in a doctor in regards to like somebody with really good bedside manner. That's not a given, by the way.
Right.
So give me some ideas.
Well, I would say the absolute first thing I think of is if you're lucky enough with family and friends, you know, like who do they see? Because like, for example, our clinic, we basically don't do any advertising and we're seeing, you know, a bunch of new people every single month, and almost every single new patient we see, there's a connection. You know, they've heard from somebody that it's a good clinic, or that my mom comes here, or my brother comes here, or my neighbor comes here. And I think that that counts for a lot. And so is maybe a correlator that I would encourage people not to rely too much on what they see online, because let's face it.
I was wondering about that. I was like, okay, did you just have all your relatives fill this out?
Well, or the opposite, you know, like a terrible Yelp review or something, you know, because you sort of figure that the people are going to go online, they're the extremes, right? They're like the people that had a horrible experience.
Or absolutely loved.
Exactly. So I think that, I mean, that can be a helpful place to start. You know, the Minneapolis St. Paul magazine just came out. There's a top doctors thing.
Right.
I'm just here to tell everyone that it's, if you're listed, it's wonderful. It's an honor. It is, quite honestly, a bit of a popularity contest. It's not a sign of like truly who, you know, especially in the primary care world. Like, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds of people who are wonderful clinicians that are not listed. And so I think that like not relying too much on that, not relying too much on the surveys and reports online, but thinking about, you know, who you've heard from, who you trust, and then they'll say, like, oh my gosh, this person was wonderful. They were patient and kind and accommodating and smart and insightful. I mean, that, maybe that sounds like a unicorn, you know, clinician, but it, you know, but people like that are out there. And so I would encourage that. And then part of it, you know, let's be, you know, quite honestly, that some people have getting to a clinic is difficult, you know,
right,
just through transportation.
Right.
So it has to be on a bus line, or it has to be on a light rail, or it has to be something that is a bit more accessible, and people don't have time to go too far out of their way to find a clinic. So looking around, you know, where do you live? You know, what are the clinics? What have you heard? I liked your way of putting it, though. It's like a dance. It's choreography. There's a little bit of a courting, as it were, that goes on, you know, that just trying to, like, oh, that didn't work. Let's you know, it's not speed dating, but there can be a little bit of that at times, like just trying to land and get the right person. So you don't have a perfect answer for that, but I do think, like, listening to family and friends is right at the top of my list.
I'm going to touch on one more thing with this, and then I'll move on. But I do feel... I guess I wonder, somebody gave me this idea. Call the clinic, explain, get a nurse to call you back, and explain to the nurse what you want. Mm-hmm. This is what I need from a doctor. Who, you know, I need a doctor who really listens, who is really attuned to people with disability issues. Are they attuned enough to do that, to separate that out?
Sure. I mean, I think of our clinic, for example, we have 3 triage nurses. Mm-hmm. They know us really, really well. And if someone like you were to call the clinic and say, like, hey, I had a not great experience with so-and-so, but here's kind of what I need. Could you make a recommendation of who might be a better fit for me, or who might kind of fit that description? They would give it to you. They'd be honest. They would share that with you, for sure.
The only thing that is sad to me is that, you know, and I realize there's complexities with this, but once you've seen your doctor for your annual visit, let's say it didn't go well for whatever reason, you know, insurance only covers so much, so then you got to wait till whenever to go to the next doctor. So that does get tricky. But
well, let me add to that. So that's I'm really glad you brought this up, because I find that, so I'll see patients, and they're coming in for their annual wellness visit, preventive care visit, checkup, physical exam. We kind of use the same terms that mean the same thing. And yeah, we all have health insurance that pays for one annual wellness visit. This is typically free. There's no copay or anything like that. But I think that people make the mistake of thinking they can only see their doctor like once a year. And what I encourage people to do, because what they'll do is they'll come in for that, and then technically speaking, if they have 3 or 4 things to talk about that are new concerns, we have to do what's called split billing, which means that we end up like having to do almost like 2 visits in one, and then the patient's responsible for paying for part of the other one. So I encourage people, like, you don't have to wait a year to come back. Just come back with the other concerns as they come up, or, you know, if there's 2 or 3 things you want to talk about. Yeah, there might be that copay, and I don't mean to downplay this, but typically it's in the $25 to $50 range. But it's worth it because I think that sometimes when people sense an irritation from their primary care clinician,
they don't talk about the other stuff.
Well, right. They'll say, oh, I'm sorry, I can't talk about that today. And then as a patient, you're going like, wait, what? Like, I've been saving up these things for nine months and now we can't talk about them. So it's very off-putting. And I think we do a terrible job of explaining that. I will tell you that even though I'm the medical director of my clinic and I should know better, I always deal with everything just because this is who I am. It's how I deal with things. Mm-hmm. But I probably should do a better job of parsing these things out. But it's just, it becomes like contractual. And that's the part of healthcare I hate is the billing and all of that. And I will be honest, I think that gets in the way sometimes of good care, good, honest conversations. We have people who come to our clinic from 300 zip codes. So some people have like, I'll even ask them, I'll say like, can you remind me, like, where did you drive in from today? And they'll say, oh, I drove in from Elk River or Hudson, Wisconsin. And it's like, okay, let's try and do that cortisone shot today in your knee. I don't want you driving back here just for that, you know?
Right.
So I try and accommodate. And I know a lot of people do. But I do think that that leads to some of that tension that people feel. It's like if we save up all our concerns for one visit and the clinician has to go through a whole checklist of wellness stuff, you know, and like you just can't get it all done in 20 minutes or 30 minutes or 40 minutes even sometimes. So I think that's sometimes part of the problem.
So what kind of preventative screenings or tests should a person kind of be aware of and ask for regardless of their ability? Or
sure.
Whatever?
So, yeah, I think that all humans, regardless of, you know, ability, disability, gender, there are, as we age, certain things that are kind of expected. And I think these days, just so everyone knows, I mean, we've clinicians pretty much know what they are. When adults hit 45, we now talk about colon cancer screening, regardless of anything. We should, mm-hmm. That's when we start. We don't have to do it every visit, but every so often we want to check glucose for diabetes. We want to check cholesterol. Men, it's a conversation about when do you get prostate cancer screening. For women, it's mammograms, pap smears, you know, like all these things. So the good news is that patients don't really need to worry about that because all of us now are on these electronic records. And when we pull them up, there's a list of all the to-dos. I mean, it's right there. They call them, you know, care gaps. And so it's like, oh, you're this age and this gender. Like, we need to do these things. Or I recommend that we do these things. We always talk about immunizations, like which ones might be due. Everyone knows, like, kids, you know, it's lots of potential shots in there early on. But it just One would hope. But, you know, yeah, again, that's a conversation we have. And that's part of our job is to talk about that and why this is important to get. But in children, it's really about growth and development. Like, are mm-hmm. they mentally developing as expected? Are they growing physically as we expect? We watch for those things really, really carefully. That's why kids come in so often when they're in the first 2 years of life. As we get older, it's, you know, we start asking things like, are you falling? Have you tripped? How's your memory? How's your hearing? What's your vision like? I mean, there's just lots of things. So good news is, I don't know that the patients really need to worry about that because that's our job. And we kind of know when people come in for that preventive visit, what they need to do. And I take, I just will say this as an aside, most people in healthcare, we're all a little bit obsessive compulsive. I mean, like, we're, you know, not diagnosed, but we're all a little bit on that spectrum because we really like to, we check off boxes, we have checklists, we are very careful. That's a good thing, you know, so that I think patients should realize that, yeah, we're kind of detail-oriented folks, and we will make sure that they get everything done that they need to get done.
I want to ask a question.
How do you feel about the a lot of organizations are using my charts now?
Oh, yeah.
How do you feel about that?
So, as we speak, I think I have 16 messages waiting for me that I need to respond to tonight or tomorrow. And I am using all these, like, Greek metaphors, but I kind of feel like I'm Atlas. I have the weight of the world on my back sometimes because, again, it's always, I'm never caught up. I'm never done.
Right.
My charts are a great communication tool because, let's face it, a lot of times we can take care of things. You don't have to come in for, if someone has recurrent UTIs, urinary tract infections, and it's like, oh, I got another one. We can just treat it. You know, we don't have to, go to urgent care. I use it, you know, every time I get a lab result, I'm sending a patient a message about, you know, putting that result in context. Any x-ray, any imaging I'm doing, we send messages. some of my patients, unfortunately, they probably think it's almost like instant messaging, which becomes a little much because it really should be like minimal correspondence. Just
right.
Like, you know, just here, I want to share this information with you. Unless I say, what do you think of that? Or would you be willing to start this medication? Not everything requires a response back, but,
right.
But it becomes a lot sometimes. So it's like the art of my chart use.
Yeah. There needs to be some kind of cultural education in regards to that. But I realize that it's all different. I'm wondering, I'm sure it's changed since the 30 to 40 years that you went to med school,
mm-hmm.
but you obviously have people who come in and that you are educating current doctors.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like the med school trains doctors on knowing how to address the needs of a patient with disabilities well enough?
Well, that's a good question. So I'm going to tell you something, I know this for a fact, that the University of Minnesota Medical School has one of the highest percentages of its student body who identify as having a disability. Now, that can be, you know, apparent and non-apparent disabilities. And in the case of medical students, it's a lot of mental health issues, depression, anxiety, ADHD, dyslexia, a number of things. So I think that there is, from the student body itself, a certain sensitivity and awareness that probably didn't exist when I started. I mean, you know, the diversity of our classes increased,
right.
More women in going to medicine, more people with disabilities, more people from all kinds of backgrounds, first generation, you know, students. So all kinds of things. So there's a diversity in the med schools now that never existed, you know, before. It's just, it's amazing. But as always, the med school curriculum is so crammed with, I mean, everybody wants a piece of it. And there's the pie isn't getting bigger. You know, it's almost like the pie's getting smaller, but the pieces are being divided up into smaller pieces.
Right.
And so to do sort of like disability education per se is tricky. But I will say that, you know, when we teach the medical students how to do an interview, how to do a physical exam, there is more attention paid to that. Like, how do we work with folks with disabilities, sensitivities, different cultural backgrounds? I mean, this is all part of the training. Is it great? Probably not. Is it better than it was when I was starting medical school in 1988? Absolutely.
How often should someone see their primary care physician if they're not sick? And if they are, how does that change?
Yeah. When people are young, let's say I've got somebody in their 20s or 30s,
mm-hmm.
they're totally healthy. They have no conditions. They're on no prescription medications. You know, we'll often say like, hey, I don't need to see you every year. I can see every 2 years. Just for folks to know, though, that if we don't see somebody for 3 years, and this is almost a universal thing, a clinic doesn't consider that patient an active patient anymore. So if they kind of disappear for a while, and then they'll say like, oh, I want to see Dr. Hallberg for my annual exam. It's like, oh, you haven't been here since 2020. They'll say, oh, no. And then they'll say, well, yeah, he's, you know, you're considered a new patient. Let's see if he can take you. I mean, just as an aside, of course,
right.
I'll take that patient back. But people may have had that experience. Like, look, I don't need to go in very often. And when I do, they say I've got to be a new patient. So that's why. But I think on average, so if people have diabetes, for example, even if it's well controlled, we want to see that patient 2 times a year, once for a wellness visit and kind of weave into that some diabetic care. But 6 months later, a diabetic visit.
And does insurance cover those 2 times?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, it's expected. I mean, there's certain like quality measures that we're measured on. And so for a diabetic, you know, they should have an A1C level done for their sugars, you know, biannually. There are certain other things that should be done. But I would say that anyone who takes a medication, and let's say it's a stable medication, you know,
mm-hmm.
if it's an antidepressant, we generally want to see people back in 2 to 4 weeks to see how they're doing and then decide what the cadence is for follow-up.
Mm.
But let's say people are, like, doing fine. They might have high blood pressure, might have high cholesterol. They just need a mammogram or, you know, colonoscopy or whatever they need. Once a year generally suffices for that. And then the door is open for when acute things come up, you know, things that are unforeseen. And you know, we We're all, as we say, like, you know, you're one infection or one accident away from life changing quite dramatically.
Right.
And so that's, again, another reason to have a primary care home, because you just, you might be healthy, and all of a sudden you're not. And Susan Sontag, many years ago, wrote a book called Illness as Metaphor. And I always misquote the opening paragraph, but it's something to the effect that all human beings have two passports. We have a passport to the world of the well, and we have a passport to the world of the unwell. And sooner or later, we will all use that other passport.
That's fascinating. I actually like that metaphor, because I feel like that is so true.
Yeah.
I wonder, there's I feel like a really touchy situation that can happen where, you know, I think we all either were good or not so good or bad at advocating for ourselves. But now I think there's become this whole tricky privacy stuff where, let's say you have an older, like a teenager, mm-hmm. 15, 16, 17 year, there becomes this whole HIPAA thing. And if there's any mental illness or whatever, or any types of unstable, let's say, it doesn't even have to be a diagnosed mental illness. If there's any trouble with that, it gets hard to have the doctor communicate with the family when the teenager maybe doesn't want that or doesn't want the parent in the room. How do you maneuver around that? Because there are times I feel like the parents need to know what's going on.
Sure.
But then there's all that privacy stuff. So how does that work?
Well, the best scenario, the best case would be that, like, let's say I, as a family physician, I take care of the parents, mm-hmm. I take care of the children. I do make it very clear, like, you know, for example, I've got a teenager and we're going to talk about sexual activity and they don't want the parents in the room. You know, I'll have them leave and we'll have that conversation. And typically, as long as no one's life is in danger, what we say in that room stays in that room, right? We're not obligated to report anything. And frankly, we really can't. We have to have that trust. Now, it's tricky when it's a minor. When it's an adult, it's very clear-cut.
You right.
know, like there's just no way. Even if I'm taking care of two spouses, you know, like the two people married to each other or living together, I have to be very careful about, like, ooh, I can't say that. You know, I they're not
even
here.
Even if there's an STI involved?
Well, that's a whole different thing. And so, but kind of with that in mind, I mean, I think that the ideal situation is that I know everybody so well that I'll talk to somebody and say, you know, it would be so helpful if we could bring your mom back in the room or your dad back in the room and have them hear this, because I think it's really important that they're part of this conversation. That would be great. But if they say, no way, and, you know, again, this is not a suicidal situation, it's not a homicidal situation, there's nothing being shared that is, you know, to that degree, then we will honor that privacy. And it can be tricky, because parents are like, but I want to know, like, what are they watching on their computer screen? Or, you know, what do they tell you? And it's like, well, I can't share that. You know, it's tricky. And I mean, I'm a parent of, well, now two adults, but I, you know, I've been a parent of teenagers and young people, and kind of my perspective is different, of course, because I'm in the business and kind of know how that goes. But I know how frustrating that can be, but we have to, because again, like, we don't want to lose the trust of the minor
right.
either, right? And that's a big problem, is that if they feel like adults aren't listening, they're not going to honor my privacy, they're just telling my parents everything, then we've lost their trust, and then they're going to lose their trust in healthcare.
Mm. We need to take another short station break. We'll be right back.
Support for KFAI comes from the Cedar, presenting Rock to Restore Research, Friday, June 20th. Rock, punk, jazz, and R&B artist Tina Shaleski will join with dirt folk storytelling musician Freak in support of Unite to Fight Paralysis, a Minneapolis-based nonprofit working to restore budget cuts to spinal cord injury research. Minneapolis rockers Zoe Says Go will also be there to lend their talents and support. To Restore Research, Tina Shaleski, Freak, and Zoe Says Go at the Cedar Cultural Center is available at thecedar.org.
And this is Disability in Progress, and I'm Sam Jasmine, and this is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. We're speaking with Dr. John Hellberg. I almost called you Jonathan Hellberg. I don't know why.
People, it's funny. I'll get doctors that send me letters and they'll be addressed to Jonathan Hellberg. And my John is, it's a kind of the Norwegian way. It's
J-O-N,
not, yeah. It's not short for Jonathan.
Interesting.
But I'll accept it, though. I'll answer to anything.
I want to step back to something you started talking about a little bit, and that was trust. And I think sometimes patients can lose trust if an appointment didn't go well in many ways, or if a doctor was rude, and maybe they were just responding to how they felt the patient was acting. So how do you ever, if you were to consult or tell doctors how to better establish trust with their patients, or tell patients how to rebuild trust after a negative experience, what would you do? What would you say?
You know, I personally have very thin skin. And so if I ever get, and this has happened to me, I mean, I can tell you right now that there were things that I learned in my first 2-3 years of practice through like patient satisfaction surveys, where I would read the, for example, let's give you an example. I remember one time somebody said that I was very cursory in my examination. Like they had come in with a cold, and I probably listened to their lungs, and you know, just wanted to make sure it wasn't pneumonia.
Right.
But they felt like the visit was too quick. And I have to tell you that ever since I read that, even if a person sees me for something that's obvious that it's just a cold, I check their ears, I check the nose, I look at the throat, I feel their neck, I listen to their lungs. It might be a little performative, but it's a match, right? The patient expected something to make sure that things are okay. And I'll even say like, hey, your ears look great, your sinuses aren't tender, your nose looks fine, your throat, I'm not seeing big tonsils, they're not red, there's no pus. We can get a throat culture if you want, but I don't think it's necessary. Your lungs are clear. I'm not hearing pneumonia. Like that takes me, 15 seconds to say all of that? But it's like really reassuring. So I would say from a patient standpoint, number one, be honest. If you've had a bad visit and you're asked about the visit, say that it didn't go well, because that will make it back to the clinician. And I will say that if a clinician has... And part of professionalism in medicine is self-reflection. And if you get from a boss, from a colleague, from a nurse, from a patient, if people are saying something, we need to listen to that. And I hope we pivot. And we try and become better. I mean, I've been doing this for a long time, but I know I can still be better. And I really strive for that. But there are times, too, when I know... every once in a while, a nurse will say, like, okay, so-and-so is in the room, and I can tell they're really irritated. Like, they know this person like I do, and it's like, okay, I'm ready because I kind of think I know what this is about. Or, I remember once, first 5 years of practice, I had a patient who kept insisting on something. I can't remember what it was. And in my note, I shouldn't have done this, but I was dictating in my note something like, the patient... simply doesn't seem to understand or doesn't seem to get it, or, you know, I'm going in circles or something, you know, I shouldn't have put that in the note. But he went to the Mayo Clinic for a second opinion, and he got copies of all of his notes that I'd done.
Oops.
Yeah. And he came in, and he was literally, his face was red. He was beet red. He put himself between me and the door, by the way, so I couldn't get out. And he went line by line with all the things he disagreed that I had written. But there again, that's 25 years ago or more?
Mm-hmm.
I still remember that. And I now know how careful I need to be with what I put in the patient chart for that reason. You know, like just, I don't want to put disparaging things. It's no place for, you know, and by the way, too, I also said that he was at baseline when I saw him. He thought that I was implying that he was like somehow not functioning normal. And at baseline means like you're just functioning at your normal level.
Right.
That's all I meant. But he misinterpreted that. You know, there's some words we can't get around.
So that's an interesting perspective because, well, first of all, I just want to touch on the example that you gave to begin with about going through and maybe being, I would call it more thorough.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see that as thin-skinned. I saw that as you taking something and saying, how could I better that? But this... the example that you gave in regards to charting, that is something I think that doctors do need to think about, like how they chart the things they write in their notes and what they put in their notes. How they say them sometimes can mean just everything. And also, I feel like maybe that could even make a difference in how other doctors see them, right?
Oh, sure.
So that is an interesting thing that you bring up now that it used to be, that you guys just saw the notes. And now with
everybody can see the notes.
Everyone gets
exactly.
to see them. Let's share it with everyone.
Funny is this is sort of a silly example, perhaps, but I've got, I know my patients really well.
Mm-hmm.
Most of my patients are absolutely wonderful human beings. They're lovely. Some are not. And then I'll refer somebody to a specialist. And somebody, my specialist, will say things like, "Dear John," or "Dear Dr. Hallberg, thank you so much for referring this lovely patient to me." And it's like, don't use the word lovely. They're not lovely. But I think they're doing it because they're trying to make me feel good about my patients. Like, look, I know they're tough as nails, and that was not an easy appointment. You don't have to make it sound like that.
Maybe
was...
there was some sarcasm didn't read.
Yes. But to your point, though, I think that, if the patient saw that, they'll want to see that they're lovely.
Instead, right.
True. But you can also just say, I saw Mrs. Johnson, and thank you for the referral, and here's my thoughts, or something. But it's mm-hmm. it's always so funny. Like, there's this sense that they need to, kind of flourish the way that they're communicating with us. But I think that, but back to this idea though, like what do you do if I know, and people, if they're really honest with me, and often it's at the end of the visit, they'll say, can I mention something? And it's like, and then I go, okay, here we go. I know this is they're gonna say something that's gonna hit hard. It doesn't happen very often, but every once in a while it does. And, you're right. I mean, I feel like I have thin skin, but I'm also very, very attentive to wanting to better myself. And so if a patient says to me, hey, that didn't go well last time, or I wish you had called me to tell me about that rather than sending me a MyChart message, say, I totally get it. I am sorry. I will make sure we don't do that the next time. And that's probably how we should respond, right?
I think that's a lovely way to respond. but I do like that. I think that's very human.
Yeah.
Very personable and very human.
And
right?
So from an empowerment standpoint, I think that patients should feel if they know their, especially their primary care physician, or maybe it's a specialist that they see all the time, and if they feel something didn't go well, I hope that they feel empowered to share that. And I hope that they realize that most of us we'll take that to heart, and we'll try and better ourselves and be better humans and better doctors.
Can you tell me, how, if a patient is coming to their primary care appointment, are there things that they would be really nice if they would prepare for or have or know?
I will answer that question, but I will also kind of start with almost the negative corollary of that.
Okay.
So for years, people have been told, when you go to the doctor, make sure you have a list so you don't forget things you wanted to mention. Mm. So 100% agree. However, if it's a 20-minute appointment and there are 14 things on the list,
they're not going to get all addressed, at least not properly.
Exactly. That's the big key. Because I was saying to my rooming staff the other day, someone came in and it was literally left knee pain. So often, that's one of six things that people want to talk about, or it's the wellness visit, and it's that. But to do a really good job, I had this great visit. It was got a great history, had the patient demonstrate how they were walking, did a really thorough knee exam, decide if any imaging was necessary. We talked about PT and whether to get a cortisone shot or see a specialist. And that took up the entire time. But it was so satisfying. And yet I think that patient actually apologized to me for coming in with just that complaint. And it's like, no, you don't understand. I love doing things like that. It's very focused. So I think just keeping that in mind, being reasonable, how thorough can I be if someone has 10, 12, 14 individual complaints? And, it's headache, fatigue, back pain, visual changes, chest pain, oh my gosh, every one of those is a thorough visit in and of itself. So, and just so people understand too, if that happens, for sure, if we do our job right, we'll probably say okay, of those things, what are the two that are really bothering you today? And then let's address those other ones in more depth, in another visit or two. And handled well, I think people would understand that and realize that they've been heard. But we just can't get into it as much as we would like if there's a ton of things to go through.
So Do you have a time constraint? What is the general time they expect for you to spend with a patient?
It completely depends. We just had a really great conversation the other day with my department colleagues about what is that appropriate time. So in some private practices, it can be a 15-minute appointment for everything,
yeah.
which you can't do things.
Nope.
I mean, you can do a sore throat in 15 minutes, but you can't do a wellness visit or a full physical exam in 15 minutes.
Right.
I don't care how good people think they are. You just can't. So time slots are everything from, and this is, again, I'm talking primary care, not like ophthalmology where you could maybe be 10 minutes with the ophthalmologist, but this is primary care. Typically it's 15, 20, 30, 40 minute visit slots, depending on where you go. I do all 30 minutes. And so some visits don't take 30, some take 40. It all kind of comes out in the wash. 30 minutes is becoming a little bit more standard now for primary care throughout the community. My colleagues, if they're listening to this, might say, like, what are you talking about, John? It's like I only get 20 minutes. And, or some people, like most of my colleagues at the clinic get 20 and 40. I just decided to go for 30 because, frankly, it makes scheduling so much easier.
Right.
Like everything gets, you don't have to worry about, oh, I can't get you into the 3 weeks because John doesn't have a 40-minute appointment, you know, available.
Gotcha.
This makes it so much easier.
I have about 2 minutes. What are your feelings on telehealth, and do you think it falls short?
Well, I'll tell you, this gets back to the fact that if you have a primary care physician who knows you, I think telehealth can be fantastic, especially like I just put someone on an antidepressant.
Mm-hmm.
I want to follow up with them in 2 weeks. We're going to get a score of kind of how they qualitatively feel. I know them really, really well. They live in Hugo. They live in, you know, wherever. It's snowing. Oh my gosh, a telehealth visit is so nice to do because, and I think, frankly, there's an ecological piece there, right? People don't have to drive and burn fossil fuel to get to the clinic if we
can
do it. So I think there's a green element to it.
But there's no weight check, blood pressure check.
Totally.
So many things
right.
that could, even looking just kind of at them face to face, I would think it might be trickier.
Yeah, so it depends. I think like medication follow-up, mental health stuff is a really good example of that. Frankly, as a family physician, I find the house call aspect kind of fun because I can see people in their environment and it's like, oh my gosh, look at that bookshelf over your shoulder or you know, tell me about that painting or you know, are you in your basement or, you know, tell me where you are. I feel like it's kind of almost like a little bit of a privilege to kind of see where people live.
Thank you so much, Dr. Hellberg, for coming on. We really appreciate it. I feel like I could have gone another 30 minutes with you easily. So
thank you so much.
I really appreciate your time and good luck with everyone.
Thank you. It was my pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
We're going to take one last short station break. We'll be right back.
Programming on KFAI is supported in part by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. Introducing the 2025 Bush Fellows, leaders working to make the region better for everyone. More information is online at bushfoundation.org.
Been listening to Disability and Progress. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of KFAI or its board of directors. My name is Sam. I'm the host of the show. Charlene Dahl is my research PR person. Aaron is my podcaster. Tonight we were speaking with Dr. John Hellberg talking about primary care and primary care doctors. This is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. If you want to be on my email list, you can certainly email me at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. Tell me your thoughts and what you'd like to hear. Next week, I will not be here because it's 24 hours of Pride, but I'll be back after that. Fresh Fruit is up next. Thanks for listening. Take care.
Programming on KFAI is supported in part by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. Introducing the 2025 Bush Fellows, leaders working to make the region better.